Hi, this is David from the Juno LA. I'm calling in for a sounds check.
Hey, David, this is Mike 1.
Mike 1, sounds good.
Mike 2.
Mike 2 is good.
Mike 3.
Mike 3 is good.
Mike 4.
4 sounds good.
Mike 5.
5 is good.
Mike 6.
6 sounds good.
Mike 7.
7 is good.
Mike 8.
Mike 8 is good.
Mike 9.
9 is good.
Mike 10.
10 sounds good.
And final mic.
Final mic is good.
Awesome. Thanks, David.
Have a good meeting.
I wish I would have known.
call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today's Monday, March 16th. We're in State Capitol Senate Finance Room. It's a couple of minutes after 9 a.m. Present today, Chairman Stedman and Olson, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. We have two items on today's agenda. One is the spring forecast, highly anticipated, and a response to committee questions after we hear the report from the Department of Revenue. We have Acting Revenue Commissioner Janelle Earls and Chief Economist Dan Stickle Esquire. Please come forward and give us what news you have for the rest of the year and for the fiscal year 2027. Please identify yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Good morning. For the record, Janelle Earls, Acting Commissioner and Administrative Services Director for the Department of Revenue. I am here in support of Chief Stickle, but he will be here to answer all your questions.
Mr. Stickle.
Sure. So for the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue, and thank you for the opportunity to present the department's spring revenue forecast. This has been one of the more interesting spring revenue forecasts, to say the least. So slide two, somewhat different layout to the presentation than what we usually do in the spring. So we'll quickly walk through the spring update for unrestricted revenue. And then I'm going to spend several slides talking about oil price volatility and uncertainty in relation to world events that have unfolded so far in March and how that impacts state revenue. And then several of the usual spring forecast slides have moved to an appendix, and we're happy to go through those after if the committee desires or leave them for future perusal. Slide three is the highlights of the spring forecast compared to the fall forecast. Our forecast for Alaska North Slope average oil prices has increased by $9.77 per barrel for the current fiscal year 2026 and by $13 per barrel for fiscal year 2027. We're now forecasting an average of $75 per barrel for the coming fiscal year 2027. Looking at oil production, our forecast for North Slope production increased by 2,100 barrels per day for the current fiscal year and by 700 barrels per day for fiscal year 2027. A highlight of that production forecast, of course, is the expectation that the Pikka field will start production in the very near future. Looking at total unrestricted revenue, we are projecting an additional $545 million for fiscal year 2026 and an additional $510 million for fiscal year 2027, with the higher oil price forecast being the primary but not the only reason for those increased revenue projections. Slide four provides some additional details on the fiscal year 2026 forecast. We've received some questions from folks and thought it would be helpful to provide this additional detail. So through the end of February, we were actually running about $115 million ahead of the fall forecast in terms of unrestricted revenue. And the primary reason for that was corporate income tax collections. We had some higher than expected non-petroleum collections, as well as we were seeing a lot of strength in the mining industry and the oil and gas services industry in particular. So as we were heading into this forecast, we were already $115 million ahead for fiscal year 2026. And looking at that total $544.7 million increase from the fall forecast, and breaking that out by detailed component, $105 million of that is due to the additional forecasted non-petroleum corporate tax revenue, again, largely reflecting revenue that we had already received as of the end of December. About $370 million of the increase is attributable to increased production tax and royalty revenue due to the higher price outlook. Production tax in particular increases substantially as prices go higher, and we have more companies expected to pay above the minimum tax floor on the production tax. About $20 million of the increase was due to additional expected oil and gas corporate tax, and that's due to the higher prices in the forecast. About $30 million of the fiscal 26 increased revenue is attributable to property tax, and that has to do with higher assessed values for oil and gas properties across the state, but in particular for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. That assessment had not been reevaluated in detail for several years, and that was done this year, resulting in additional expected property tax for the state as well as the municipalities. And then finally, about $18 million of additional other non-petroleum revenues. Mining is a big piece of that, driven by high gold and silver prices, as well as investment revenue driven by slightly higher earnings on general fund cash.
Questions on this slide? Senator Stedman?
Just to help me a little bit, I'm just kind of curious on TAPS, because we've got significant production increases coming, and historically, how often is that, or should that be updated in a perfect world? Both for increasing and decreasing production. Because it could go either side of the coin. But
sure, Co-Chair Stedman, and I don't know exactly what the timeline is for doing the full TAPS assessment. What I do know is that that's something our property tax group looks at periodically, so not every year, but on a periodic basis. And since the last time that the full TAPS assessment was done, costs have increased, so the value of property generally has increased, as well as expected pipeline duration has increased with expected production from new developments.
Senator Stedman? Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
So moving on to slide five, this highlights the three primary components of the unrestricted revenue forecast. Investment revenue being the largest source of unrestricted revenue, contributing about $3.8 billion in fiscal year 2025, estimated at $3.9 billion in fiscal year 26, and $4.1 billion in fiscal year 27. And the main element of that investment revenue forecast is the percent of market value transfer from the permanent fund. Petroleum revenue generated $1.9 billion of unrestricted revenue in fiscal year 2025, and we're forecasting $1.8 billion in fiscal year 2026 and back to $1.9 billion in fiscal year 2027. And then lastly, non-petroleum sources contributed $639 million in fiscal year 2025. We're forecasting about $740 million in fiscal 26 and about $760 million in fiscal year 2027. And so in total, again, we're forecasting $6.5 billion of unrestricted revenue in fiscal year 26, which would be up from $6.3 billion in the prior year. And for fiscal year 27, our revised forecast is $6.7 billion. So the next several slides will look at oil prices and oil price uncertainty. That's been really the big story for the forecast as we've looked to pull the numbers together over the last few weeks. So slide six shows our spring 2026 oil price forecast for Alaska North Slope oil and a comparison to the fall revenue forecast. And we also included in the dotted line what the forecast was looking like as of mid-February. So we did a preliminary a run in February, and then the significant increase in prices has really been since then. We used the futures market as the basis for our price forecast for as many years as possible, and then we apply an inflation assumption beyond fiscal year 2033. The futures market provides a timely and transparent source of information about future price expectations. Given the uncertainty in the oil markets with the conflict in the Middle East, we pushed the price forecast, we pushed the date for finalizing that out as long as we possibly could while still meeting the March 13th release target. And so we generated our price forecast on March 11th, which was last Wednesday. We used the futures data based on the median trading futures price for the 5 days ending Wednesday, March 11th. So fiscal year 2026 forecast, again, expected to be $9.77 above what we were forecasting in the fall. And then we have a $13 per barrel increase to the fiscal year 27 forecast, an $8 per barrel increase for the fiscal year 28 forecast. And then for fiscal year 28 and beyond, we're actually expecting many years in a row of prices averaging right around $69 to $70 per barrel. Once you get out into the early 2030s, the change from the fall forecast is very small, if any.
Kaufman.
Thank you. Wondering, forecasts are notoriously tricky. I'm just wondering, do we have any kind of accuracy analysis, like a historical accuracy analysis of, well, this is what we forecast, this is what it was, and kind of a scatter plot or something like that that shows you know, maybe ratios of how often we overestimate or underestimate if we have upside surprises or downside and what the ratio of those might be?
Sure. Senator Kaufman, through the chair. So that's an analysis that we have done in the past, in particular looking at different sources for oil price forecasts. Yes, as you're correct, oil forecasts are wrong. The futures market tends to be the most accurate of the bunch. And looking forward, there is a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and that's what a couple of the coming slides will get at.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Please proceed.
And that's a great segue into slide seven. Slide seven shows what's happened with oil prices so far this decade, since 2020. Prices have averaged about $74 per barrel since January of 2020, but they've been anything but stable. Uncertainty has really been the story. So in 2020, we started with prices around $70 per barrel, and they crashed during the peak COVID pandemic, and our Alaska North Slope price actually went negative for a day in April of 2020. And then prices increased to over $125 per barrel following Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022. And since the Ukraine war started, generally prices have been on a fairly stable to slightly declining path. We were in the low 60s at the beginning of this calendar year, and then prices had started to increase throughout 2026 as there was just a little bit of uncertainty in the market about potential Middle East situations, and then spiked to over $100 per barrel just in the last week. Slide 8 is an index of oil volatility. And so what this is it's a market index. It tracks the expected volatility of crude oil prices over the coming month, based on looking at the options market and pricing for options to buy and sell oil at different oil prices. The absolute numbers here are less important, but the key concept is that a high oil volatility index, or OVIX, reflects a high level of uncertainty, and a lower level of volatility reflects expectations for more stable oil prices. And what this chart shows is what we kind of understand anecdotally. This just puts it in statistical terms, that there is a lot of uncertainty in the oil market right now. The current levels of oil volatility are actually the second highest on record since this index debuted in 2007. second only to the peak COVID pandemic when we had the negative oil prices. So the level of uncertainty around future prices in the oil markets now is higher than during the peaks of the Great Recession in 2008-2009. And it's higher than when Russia invaded Ukraine. It's higher than any of the COVID spikes other than the initial April 2020 spike. What does that mean for our price forecast? Turning to slide 9. So this slide shows our spring revenue forecast and a range of potential prices. Again, these are implied probabilities of prices based on options market for oil prices. Looking a couple of months out, there is a 10% chance that oil prices will go well over $200 per barrel later this fiscal year. There is a 10% chance that oil prices will fall to $30 per barrel later this fiscal year. These are looking at options prices that you can buy and sell right now for May oil prices. So just a tremendous amount of uncertainty in the market. Our oil price is a most likely case within a very wide range of potential outcomes. Looking out to fiscal year 2027, that 10% probability range would be between 10% chance of $45 on the low end and 10% chance of $130 on the high end, with our $75 per barrel forecast being a point in the middle of that range. Slide 10 translates this to revenue and shows how revenue for fiscal year 2026, our current fiscal year that ends in June, could change with different oil prices. So through the end of February, Alaska North Slope oil prices averaged $67.34. Our forecast for March through June is $91.09 per barrel, and that results in a forecast of $6.5 billion of unrestricted general fund revenue. Near that forecasted price, a $1 increase or decrease in Alaska North Slope prices over just these last 4 months of the fiscal year is about a $15 million change for total unrestricted revenue. And we've been seeing price changes up into the double digits, so a lot of uncertainty there. We added that 10% chance from the prior slide as a dotted line here. So there's based on the 10th percentile of prices for the remainder of the fiscal year, we could end up with less than $6 billion of unrestricted revenue. On the high end, it could be well over $7.5 billion. So that's a $1.5 billion range just based on prices for the next 4 months.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, if they can help a little bit, what with the supplemental requests that are in play now for FY26, and I think there's a couple of them that are going to be on the table for another $15 million coming up. What do we need for a break-even price when we look at the entire year of FY26 that we have to average?
Mr. Stickle.
Co-Chair Stedman, and that's exactly why we show this slide and have an accompanying sensitivity matrix in the book. I don't have the exact break-even based on the most recent version of the supplemental. My understanding is it would be somewhat lower than the spring forecast, that the spring forecast would cover the most recent version of the supplemental. But we include this slide to make it easy to kind of look at the type of price level that you'd need to cover various levels of spending.
Okay, and if you could,
Senator Stedman.
Could we get a dollar amount? I mean, from today going forward, we don't have to worry about the $15 million that's going to come on the table. $15 million doesn't put us in the poorhouse. It's when we're dealing with hundreds of millions at the table here. We get jammed up. What would be the price from today going forward that would make FY26 break even, where we wouldn't have to have a draw on the CBR to pay the bills.
Sure, Co-Chair Stedman, we'd be happy to, through the chair, we'd be happy to run that number and provide any additional documentation. Just kind of relating to that, we did include two new tables in the revenue, in the spring revenue forecast document this year. So we included a sensitivity analysis in $5 price increments for the remainder of fiscal year 2026, and then also for the full years of fiscal years 27, 28, and 29. Just acknowledging the uncertainty in these questions around revenue, so members of the public can see that, but we'll be happy to calculate an exact break-even number for the committee.
Could you give us, you know what the price of oil is today? It's just a benchmark. $95.
Co-Chair Hoffman, we were over $100 on Friday. I understand prices have been changing by the minute. Last time I looked, we were down a few percent for WTI, which would, West Texas Intermediate, the U.S. benchmark, that would equate to an Alaska price of around $100 per barrel today.
Thank you.
As of a couple hours ago. Slide 11 shows the monthly values for our Alaska North Slope oil price for fiscal year 2026. This was a request of the committee to show exactly how we got to our full year price forecast. So again, prices were ranged between $62 and $73 for monthly values for the first 8 months of the fiscal year. We're forecasting $91.09 for the last 4 months, and that's based on elevated prices for March through May, and then prices starting to retreat in June is what the futures market is predicting. And again, we closed over $100 per barrel last week, so we're actually a little bit above our forecast so far, but that could change very quickly, as we've seen with oil price movements over the last couple weeks. Slide 12 is our usual unrestricted revenue sensitivity chart for fiscal year 2027, the coming fiscal year, and showing how that would change with various oil prices. So at our forecast price of $75 per barrel, the unrestricted revenue would be $6.7 billion. That includes the percent of market value transfer from the permanent fund and all other revenues. Near the forecasted price for fiscal year 2027, each dollar change in price leads to about a $40 million change in unrestricted revenue, according to the fall forecast. That's a little bit higher than what we were saying $40 million under the spring forecast. That's a little higher than we were saying under the fall forecast, because we're at a higher price level where we're expecting more companies to pay above the minimum tax under the production tax regime. And when you start to look at the sensitivity to a dollar change in price, the production tax regime ends up being kind of a critical component there, as companies are very close to that crossover point between the gross minimum tax floor and the net profits tax. We are estimating that crossover point in the aggregate is about $72 per barrel in this spring forecast. It was expected to be around $76 per barrel in the fall forecast. And again, on this slide, like we did on the 2026 version, we included a dotted line showing the 10% chance price on the low end and the high end, and what sort of revenue that would bring in. And between the low end and the high end, there's a $3.5 billion range of potential unrestricted revenue to the state, and still a 1 in 5 chance that we end up outside of that range. So lots of uncertainty around what the next year will bring for oil prices.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at the spring forecast at $72, roughly is what you're saying, we've flipped from the minimum tax to the profit-sharing tax. And now we're in the fall, it was 76. So we went from 76 to 72. How much change in that crossover point can be equated to companies that have expenditures but no production?
Mr. Stickle.
Co-chair Stedman, through the chair. So the crossover point is based only on companies that have production and are expected to be paying production tax now. So the companies without current production don't impact that crossover point.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stedman.
Slide 13 shows our total unrestricted revenue. This is a history since 2020, fiscal year 2020, as well as the fall 2025 forecast and our updated spring 2026 forecast for the next 10 years. So we received about $7 billion per year of total unrestricted revenue in fiscal years 22 and 23. We are expected to get back to that level in total, not until about fiscal year 2030. The revenue forecast was increased for all of the years over the 10-year forecast in this spring update, but the biggest increases to that revenue are really this fiscal year and the coming fiscal year, with more modest increases to the projections in the later years. Through the end of the 10-year forecast, our long-term outlook is roughly keeping up with expected inflation. So if you were to put this into real dollars terms, these would be flat lines, essentially. And then a couple other slides that move away from the oil-specific forecast. Slide 14 shows our percent of market value transfer from the permanent fund and some of the related assumptions for that. For fiscal year 26 through 36 of the 10-year forecast, so we are estimating over $3.8 billion each year transferred to the general fund, and with that number steadily increasing to nearly $5.3 billion by fiscal year 2036. In real terms, roughly keeping pace with inflation in the official forecast. The percent of market value transfer is based on an assumption of a 7.3% long-term annual return for the permanent fund and a 5% market value transfer calculation based on a trailing. The calculation is based on 5% of the ending value of the fund for the first five of the last six fiscal years, so it's a trailing average, with the effective draw being a little under that headline 5% rate. The permanent fund transfer, given the way that calculation is done, it becomes a fairly stable revenue source, and that removes a lot of the impacts of market volatility over the short and medium term. So the value of that transfer is known for fiscal year 26 and 27, even in light of volatility in the investment markets. And then slide 15 is looking at some information around mining revenues. So prior to March, this was going to be kind of the story of the spring revenue forecast that we were going to highlight, but still wanted to include a slide here. So minerals prices have really soared this year. We had record gold prices over $5,000 per ounce. We had record silver prices over $100 per ounce. Prices for other minerals like zinc and lead, copper, were also up. This is a real boon to existing mines in the state. It also increases the attractiveness of potential new mines in the state. And based on the higher prices, we're now expecting over $200 million of revenue from the mining industry in fiscal year 2027, including $189 million of unrestricted general fund revenue. Looking just at the unrestricted revenue piece, that's more than a $100 million increase from fiscal year 2025 through 2027. The forecast includes an expectation over $100 million for mining license tax. So that's our severance tax on mining. nearly $80 million in corporate income taxes from mining companies, and we're looking at over $30 million in state royalties from mining, which splits between unrestricted revenues as well as contributions to the permanent fund, the public school trust fund, and program receipts for the Department of Natural Resources. So last content slide is slide 16, some takeaways from the spring update. So we are forecasting a little over $500 million of additional revenue unrestricted for both fiscal year 26 and fiscal year 27, based primarily on the high oil prices. Those higher oil prices are expected to be temporary, and there's a lot of uncertainty around those prices, as I mentioned earlier. Looking just at fiscal year 2027, while our forecast is $75 per barrel, there is a 10% chance that the price could be over $130 per barrel for the fiscal year, or a 10% chance that the price could be $45 per barrel or below. So I guess the message here is to plan for the possibility that revenue doesn't come in exactly at what we forecast for the next couple years. And then to highlight that the structure of the permanent fund draw acts as a source of a very stable foundation for the revenue forecast. That's over two-thirds of the unrestricted revenue, and we do know that with certainty. And then the volatility from the oil market is really layered on top of that. And so, Mr. Chairman, that's the end of the primary presentation. I do have a number of appendix slides I'd be happy to walk through or leave to the committee, as you please.
Thank you. And in your press release on the first page, the last sentence, I think is probably the most telling. It says the price forecast presented a most likely scenario within range of potential outcomes. Oil prices over the next year could be materially higher or materially lower. And it is within those ranges that we have to view when we're looking at the supplemental. So if they are materially lower and we don't know that, I think that is why the Senate proposed a draw on the CBR to just in case the prices are materially lower. It's not that we will be spending those dollars. If they are not needed, they will stay in the CBR. But the slight chance that they are lower, this will not necessitate us coming back to review the results and address it in August. So it's been said that we would be wasting the potential earnings. That is not the case. Basically, it says that it protects us if the prices are materially lower. So I think that the Senate's position today could have been lower than the $373 million, but just because we have the amount of $373 million, that is not to say that we are going to access those funds. It's just on what the price may be. Senator Stedman, do you have a question? Yeah,
well, on that safety net issue, I would agree with that. You know, there's reasonable likelihood that we have a chance of adding to the CBR, frankly, at the end of this year, depending on what's going on. But dealing with this price forecast, a low of $45 and a high of $130, could we get the distribution data on that? Because it doesn't look like a normal distribution. It looks like it's shifted somewhat. If there's a, you know, what's a 68% probability of, you know, one standard deviation away and two standard deviations away? Because I think that's what I think that would be helpful than just the extremes of 95.
Mr. Stickle?
Sure. Co-Chair Stedman, referring to slide 9, and we'd be happy to provide any percentile calculation, including one or two standard deviations. We included the 10th, 25th, 50th, 75th, and 90th percentile for this chart, just to avoid the standard deviation jargon, but happy to provide more detailed ranges within this.
Senator Stedman.
I think that would be helpful. I recognize that you don't want to sometimes put this stuff up on the screen because it gives some people headaches, but it would be helpful. And then the break-even price, including the supplementals, so we have a target on our bulletin board that we can hope to hit at the end of this fiscal year.
Further questions for Mr. Stickle? Go ahead and present the next presentation. Go over that, please.
All right. Mr. Chairman, happy to switch gears. I believe we were going to do a brief at ease to pull up the other presentation.
Okay. Yeah, we'll have a brief at ease. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. That brings us to the second item on today's agenda, responses from committee questions from the Department of Revenue. Dan Stickle, do you have the floor?
Sure. Again, for the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. So the next slide deck is a response to some questions that came up when we were delivering our order of operations presentation back in February, which I've heard from some folks is their favorite presentation of the year. And what we did here is we were asked to do some life cycle modeling of potential oil fields and look at oil field economics under current law and a couple of scenarios. We have a response letter that went with this, but I think all of the responses basically summarize the information in this presentation. So we were just going to kind of walk through the main slides for this. So we have a list of acronyms on slide 2 that are for the presentation. So slide 3, overview. So we have a detailed, we call it a life cycle oil field economic model, and basically what it looks at is all of the inputs and outputs, costs and revenues for developing an oil field from the beginning when the investments are made through the end of field life when the field is completed, and looks at returns to the producer and various government entities, state, local, federal, over the life of that project, allows us to calculate net present values, returns on investment. And so really, we're looking at the economics, and what we're doing here is we're looking at a typically a hypothetical field. We have done analysis for actual fields. We have white papers on the department website looking at full field economic modeling for the Willow and Pica fields based on public information. But what we're presenting here is a hypothetical field. And this kind of this concept of life cycle modeling for folks that have been around for a while, this is similar to analysis we prepared multiple times over the years, including as we were evaluating the petroleum profits tax, the ACES tax, the Senate Bill 21 tax, and different refinements to those taxes to really understand the impact of tax regimes on full field economics over time. Slide four, for this particular analysis, we have one hypothetical new field. It's intended to be kind of a simplified version of a larger new development, like a Pica or a Willow type of field. This is one set of assumptions to illustrate the economics. We can fully change any of these assumptions and run scenarios as needed. But for this analysis, we assume a field with 500 million barrels of total production over life of field. It's a lower cost development, as many of the new developments are, with a total cost of $25 per barrel over life of field. We are assuming that this is a field that's on state land with a 20% gross value reduction, so it's paying at the 12.5% royalty rate. Slide five shows the production and cost profiles for the hypothetical field that we've modeled. The field has high capital costs up front, peaking at about $2 billion per year, and then operating costs coming on once the field is in production. This hypothetical field has production peaking at around 100,000 barrels per day, staying at that plateau for several years before declining following a natural field production curve. So kind of the same concept of a high initial production, a plateau, and then a decline that we're expecting for our large new fields. Again, not exactly modeling a Willow or a Pica, but intended to represent that type of a new large field generally.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, 2027, the capital spending just appears out of nowhere. I'm just wondering about all of the spending, the impact of that leading up to that. So there's a tremendous amount of activity for exploration, you know, then site, just all of the work that's done preliminary to the beginning of actual, you know, execution, capital expenditure. So is that the view here? We're looking at it as if the project were fully ready to execute without all of that advanced work and spending.
Sure. Senator Kaufman, through the chair. So there's kind of two ways that you can look at that question, and you're correct. There is a significant amount of spending that happens prior to a project reaching a final investment decision. So one way of looking at it would be that this is kind of the expectation based from final investment decision forward. And that those exploration costs are considered sunk costs. Another way of looking at it would be that first year of capital expenditures includes those exploration costs for modeling purposes. I know when we did the Willow and Pica white papers, that's the assumption that we made, is we basically rolled in those exploration costs into that first year capital cost just as a modeling convention.
Senator Kaufman.
Okay, just to be clear, you're saying that this peak, what you're showing here rolls up the pre-FID spending into this?
Senator Kaufman, through the chair, that's one way to look at it. Again, this is a hypothetical field with hypothetical numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Kaufman.
I'm just making sure I understand, you know, how the cost of project is being reflected, and And if appreciating that it's a static model, snapshot type thing, but how it's accounting for that.
Sure, Senator Kaufman, through the chair. So I think for purposes of discussion, to assume that we're rolling up those costs into the first year, that's probably a good way of looking at it. Again, the idea is to have a hypothetical profile, and then when we're looking at sensitivities of different tax systems on that, to kind of allow for an apples to apples based on that particular field profile. And again, we have ability to run all sorts of sensitivities on this if we want to ramp costs up or down.
Okay. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Please proceed.
So slide six summarizes the scenarios that we were asked to look at from the committee. So this is, we use the price deck from the fall 2025 forecast as we produced this response last month before releasing the spring forecast 3 days ago. The higher prices in the spring forecast, we did look at that briefly. That would only slightly change the numbers in the analysis. It wouldn't change the overall conclusions. And part of the reason that it wouldn't change the overall conclusions is that the higher price deck in the spring forecast is really for this year and next. And so once the new field would come on production in our forecast, it would be kind of beyond the impact of the higher spring forecast. So we had questions about three tax regimes. We were asked to prepare economic modeling under current law. We were asked to look at that without the gross value reduction, which is the provision of the production tax code that allows a benefit for new fields for the first 3 to 7 years of production. And then we were asked to look at ACES, or Alaska's Clear and Equitable Share. That was the production tax regime that was in place prior to 2014 when it was replaced by Senate Bill 21. We looked at two different types of producers, either an existing producer with significant additional production, developing a new field, or a new entrant with no current production. The tax system treats those two types of companies very differently. Slide 7 is a refresher on the ACES tax regime. Again, this was the tax regime in place prior to 2014. ACES had a 25% net tax rate and then a progressive surcharge that applied at higher oil prices above $30 of profit per barrel. ACES had the same 4% minimum tax floor based on gross value that we have now. The tax credit system under ACES was different from what we had now. So ACES had a 20% capital expenditure credit instead of the per taxable barrel credits that we have now. ACES had a 25% credit for net operating losses instead of the lease expenditure carry forward provision that we have now. A big difference between the two tax regimes was how the minimum tax floor was applied. It was a soft floor under ACES in that all of those tax credits could be used to reduce taxes below the minimum tax floor. The tax floor is harder under current law in that per taxable barrel credits for non-gross value eligible production, which is the legacy fields, if a company uses those per taxable barrel credits or applies any carry forward annual losses in their production tax calculation, those are limited to the minimum tax floor. So a harder floor under current law than under ACES. That becomes an important concept when you're comparing state revenue and field economics under the two tax systems. For modeling purposes, we assumed that under ACES that the credits would be carried forward and applied against a tax liability. We wanted to filter out questions around potential state purchase of tax credits. That's something that was available for some companies, but not all under ACES, and existed for the first several years of Senate Bill 21. We assumed that for both tax regimes, any credits could only be carried forward and applied against a tax liability.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, one other element of ACES was, I think, that the rate got modeled or got applied on monthly average prices so that Alaska shared in temporary spikes. Any reflection of that in your modeling, or do we assume a flat year-long oil price?
Yeah, Senator Keel, through the chair, that's a good question. So we assume a stable oil price for each year. We're not accounting for potential monthly volatility.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
So slide 8 is my tell you the conclusions up front slide. Summarizes the analysis. We do have detailed modeling slides in the appendix that we're happy to walk through if the committee desires. Essentially, our hypothetical field is marginally economic to the producer in every scenario that we ran. The internal rate of return for the producer is between 12 and 14%. That's a positive return, but it's not great. We hear that typically something like a 15% or higher internal rate of return is what companies are looking for to make major investments like this. And so that's kind of a key concept, is that under the price forecast that we had in the fall and in the spring beyond these next couple of years, there's just not a lot of excess profit to capture in the oil industry. For a new entrant, we would get more state revenue without the gross value reduction and even more revenue under ACES. And related to that, a company's rate of return would be lower without the gross value reduction and without ACES. And that makes sense that if we take more revenue as a state, the company would get less revenue and it would make the investment less attractive. For an incumbent producer, it's a little bit different. We would still get more money without the gross value reduction, and the company would still have a lower rate of return without the gross value reduction. But under ACES, we would get much less revenue before the new field. So the incremental revenue from the new field would be higher than under SB 21. But then the internal rate of return for the incumbent is also higher. So you would get more revenue. We would get more incremental revenue from ACES, but then the company would also have a higher rate of return. How does that make sense? So basically under ACES, we have a low take when spending is high and a higher take when spending is low. And given the way that ACES and SB 21 take revenue over time, you can actually have a situation where the state can get more revenue and the field can be more attractive to the company. A broad observation, state revenue is higher across the board for a project from a new entrant. Internal rates of return are lower across the board for a new entrant. And that's a function of our slope-wide ring fence and the fact that a current producer can write off development costs immediately in some cases, whereas a new entrant, they have to delay their ability to write off those expenditures.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's interesting. So the price you use to run these at, it'd be interesting to know that. And then I know with some of these different tax regimes, they all respond a little different with variable price swings. Some of them have more upside, looking at it from the state's perspective, more upside and higher prices to offset more exposure on the low side to the state, hoping that through the swings that it all comes out in the wash. So can you help us with that when you what price you've run this at, and then what kind of variabilities we'd see here if we actually went back and ran these through, say, the last 10 years of actual prices, price movements?
Sure, Co-Chair Stedman. So the price deck that we used for this modeling was the fall revenue forecast. Fall forecast had an Alaska North Slope oil price of $62 per barrel for fiscal year 27. Increasing to $75 per barrel for fiscal year 2036, and then we assume that prices would increase with inflation beyond fiscal year 2036. Obviously, there is sensitivity to oil prices in all of these metrics. We'd be happy to run sensitivity on that to the extent that it's helpful. We picked one price deck for our baseline analysis just to simplify the analysis to start.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful to see how that works. If we could pick a 15-year actual history or something, and try to replicate that. I think we've done that up at the table before. That would be nice. And the other, because there's doesn't look like there's that much difference within these tax structures, but there actually is. I think when you look at it under, that's what I'd expect when we have different pricing environments. It could be substantially different. And then I think when we did ACES, I can't remember the price ranges we were using when we did that analysis and looked at that versus the other tax bills. Maybe you could help us with that, because we had multiple presentations, but they were all within particular range of oil prices.
Sure, Co-Chair Stedman. So we would be happy to provide some price sensitivity. We can look at a couple of scenarios. I think we would start by updating this with the spring revenue forecast as a new baseline, now that we have that available. And then we could look at a scenario that uses maybe the last 10 or 15 years of historical prices, and then we could look at a higher and a lower oil price scenario. Comparing ACES to Senate Bill 21, in general, ACES is a more progressive tax. So in general, ACES takes more revenue at higher oil prices. Senate Bill 21 takes more revenue at lower oil prices.
And Senate Bill 21 is current law.
Current law, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed.
Slide 9 is some additional, some kind of overall observations from modeling. So again, there's a timing delay in state revenue from new projects. That's true under any of these proposed tax systems. That's an intentional policy decision to support project economics and recoup some state value on the back end once the project is paid off for the producer. The ACES analysis is tricky, so we would get more revenue from ACES for a new project. Looking specifically at the tax paid by that specific project, but under the fall revenue forecast, we would get less tax revenue overall under ACES, and that's a function of the minimum tax floor largely. And just a reminder that our production tax is very complicated, and so a different set of assumptions would yield very different results. Again, as I mentioned for the prior question, we ran one case for this particular analysis. If we were looking in depth at an oil tax change proposal, we would want to look at not only a range of prices, which we're planning to follow up with, but also a range of company types and a range of field profiles, as each individual company field is going to perform very differently under different price levels. And so that was the end of the content. I have a whole appendix full of these model dashboards that we're happy to walk through or leave these to the committee. But basically, the way these dashboards work is we have the assumptions on the top left. We have a section for share of profits over field life below that. On the bottom left, we have a chart of annual cash flows. On the top right, we have a chart of annual state revenues. And on the bottom right, we have a chart of net present value. And you can see at what point the field becomes net present value positive for the producer and other stakeholders. And then in the middle is the numbers for the summary data that we walked through earlier. And so each of the appendix slides has a dashboard that presents this information for each of the different scenarios we ran.
Senator Stedman?
Yeah, just a couple of concepts, one of which is we're not going to go into it today, but different tax structures incentivize production at different enthusiasms. And also, Mr. Chairman, one of the things I think we don't have is that I'm concerned about is a lack of a cost recovery limit where you have multiple, like here we have one set of assumptions for one field expansion, but we have multiple years that are going to be layered. We always do. Hopefully you're a going concern, so you're going to continue to do the development. But we should have at some point some discussion on how much of the cost recovery the state should be exposed to on the carry forward, so we can ensure for the sovereign we have revenue coming in where we don't have multiple projects. And even though the end of the accounting cycle, it all comes out in the wash, more or less, with time value of money, but we don't want to go broke or have the industry go broke between point, time zero to time 30 or whenever the multiple projects are going to come full cycle. And we spent a lot of time, as I recall, over the years looking at one development, not stacked developments. And I think we need to be cognizant of that and have that discussion. And I think cost recovery limits are used all over the world. It does push the return metrics more positive to the state, negative to the industry. So you've got to keep that in balance with whatever tax you have. It all goes in together in a package. You can't just move one item and expect everything else to stay the same. So when you move one lever, it's going to affect other levers. Just for clarity here, you can't just go in and throw a cost recovery limit on it without taking a look at your tax rate itself. You'll be imbalanced.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I'd just like to offer that some of that's cause and effect. We change policy. It can drive reactions either for better or worse. And so some of this is the impulse that we're seeing going through the system from changing policy and the impact that it has, the investment decisions. So something that I think is good to remember as we're looking at these issues.
Senator Stedman.
And one other just quick note, I think we also have to remember that the economics worldwide have changed in the last 15 years. We need to take that into account. I think with legislative budget and audit, that process is slowly getting underway. So I would caution people to not go back to data that's 20 years old and assume all cost structures stay the same, because things are different today.
We'll have you go over new entries in current law at this point. This slide.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, kind of walking through the dashboard here, and if there's detailed technical questions, I believe I have a lifeline available. So the top left bar shows the detailed assumptions. So we're assuming our hypothetical large field with the 500 million barrels of total production. We're assuming that this field is located on state land. We're assuming that it's being developed by a new entrant, so this would be a company that does not have any current production in the state. We are assuming a $25 total cost per barrel. That's averaged over the life of the field for operating and capital expenditures. And we are assuming in this example the existing Senate Bill 21 structure for per taxable barrel credits and minimum tax. Over that, we show the split of profits over the life of the field, and you can see that over the life of the field, producer share is a little over half of total profits. The state share is about a third of total profits. Municipalities are about 5% of total profits, and federal government is about 13% of total profits through federal income tax. Shifting to the bottom left, we show the annual cash flows for the project split out between state, municipalities, federal government, and producers. So you see there are significant outlays for the first several years of production for the producer. Now those outlays are a little bit, those cash outlays are actually a little bit less than what we showed on the total capital cost, and that has to do with the assumption that there are some tax offsets for those outlays. And then the producer has a pretty significant return on investment, a return of capital early on in field life, with the state being a more stable, relatively more stable return of capital, because we royalties are a large piece of that. Much of the production tax is assumed to be at the minimum tax floor over time. And then federal government share really kicks in the kind of mid-2030s once we assume that the producer has used up any carried forward losses for federal corporate tax purposes. Looking in terms of annual state revenue on the top right, so this shows 10 years of state revenue. So the state would receive minimal revenue for the first 3 years while the field is under development. The small amount of revenue that we do receive is going to be annual rental payments on the state lease. And then once the field comes on production in fiscal year 2029, we start to receive state royalty revenues. In this hypothetical, there would be about $150 million in fiscal year 2030, and then approaching $300 million in fiscal year 2031. And we show that state production tax would really kick in fiscal year 2036 materially, and that has to do with the timing of gross value reduction So that's the provision that allows companies to offset their taxes for new developments. For the first several years of production, a new entrant would be expected to use their per taxable barrel credits to go below the minimum floor and pay us essentially zero production tax until they graduate from the gross value reduction, and then they're subject to the hard floor. The bottom right is the net present value calculations for the various producers. You see that the government entities are net present value positive from the outset, while the producer has a large negative net present value to begin with, as they are outlaying all of the funds for construction and development before the field comes into operation, and then the producer goes net present value positive sometime in the late 2030s to around 2040. And this analysis ends up with a total net present value for the field of a little under $1 billion. And then the top middle of the chart is the summary data that puts numbers to each of those different items. So total production tax to the state of $1.65 billion over life of project, total of $6.7 billion of state revenue for the over life of project. If you put that in net present value terms with a 10% discount rate, the value to the state for this hypothetical development is $1.9 billion in current dollar terms. And then the producer outlays a total of $5 billion, takes in a total of $14.7 billion for a net positive cash flow of $9.7 billion. But using a 10% discount rate, that net present value to the producer is only $942 million for this major development, which gives an expected internal rate of return of 13.1%. And so that's kind of the summary of this first slide, and the subsequent slides are a similar quantity of extremely detailed data and analysis, and we'll be following up with many more slides that look like this for our response document.
Senator Stedman.
Just on the, if I could get some help with the split of profits, the yellow one, the 5%, what is that one?
So, Chair Stedman, the yellow is the share of profit to the municipalities. We assume that the North Slope Borough in this case, this would be their share of property tax. Mm. So there's a 20 mils or 2% property tax on oil and gas property in the state. When the property is located in the municipality, they get a significant share of that. It's about 90% of the property tax on the North Slope Borough flows to the borough, with the remainder to the state.
Well, I was hoping, Mr. Chairman, that was an error. It should be Southeast Highlands. But I guess I got the wrong location.
Co-Chair Stedman, if we were to have oil and gas development in the Southeast Islands, it would be a similar situation where they would get the majority of the property tax revenue. Oh, yeah.
Senator Stedman, get your drill rigs out.
Yes. And just, if I could, on a more serious note.
Mr. Stedman.
Cost oil. It would be nice to have a little footnote. I know you got lots and lots of data on here, but the cost oil, because that's significant numeric, that would be easily overlooked when we look at the split of profits. But there's a big component there also.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Just like to go back to the producer internal rate of return. So that 13.1, that's not stellar. And just for the folks at home, can we just elaborate on that a little bit? I've been in enterprises that were saying if we weren't hitting 15, that there were going to be staffing reductions, contraction, and general bad things happening. So can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure, Senator Kaufman, through the chair. And that kind of aligns with what we're seeing. So under the fall revenue forecast price deck, projects in the state, and honestly, lots of projects around the world, are marginally economic. And so, yes, you know, we hear that kind of 15% is kind of a benchmark that a lot of large companies look at. Other companies, their benchmark may be higher or lower. Certainly some of the smaller companies with a higher cost of capital would be looking at a higher benchmark than a 15% to secure that capital. But under any of these sensitivities that we ran, there's not a lot of profit to share. The investments are marginal. And this is under the fall revenue forecast. The numbers look a little bit better under the spring revenue forecast, but not a whole lot.
Senator Kaufman.
I think that's a point that we need to really think about. I know it's easy to think that there's so much money being made, but there's also so much money being spent to make that money. And at a point, oil production turns into something more like mining. Instead of moving a lot of rock to get a little bit of gold, you're moving a lot of water to skim off a little bit of oil from it. And so the productivity of the fields decline over time, and a lot of work goes into getting the oil that keeps the pipeline up and running and kind of above critical mass for function. So I think that number right there is very telling and within the context of things we've been talking about in this building. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions of the department? Any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to come and present today, and happy to provide any additional information that would be helpful to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. That concludes the morning meeting. Our next meeting will be this afternoon at 1:30. We will have more amendments from Office of Management and Budget, as well as response to committee questions. With that, we are adjourned.